Welcome to The Critique, where today we're looking at a rigorous 12-commitment pre-implementation protocol for creating transformational laboratories to test civilizational healing practices in bounded, real-world settings.
And jumping right into the feedback, the extensive interlocking frameworks here, while logically sound, risk overwhelming the community stakeholders whose authority they are designed to protect.
Yeah, I mean, the tension there just jumps right off the page. The overarching intention of this framework is, it's incredibly noble. It's fundamentally about redistributing power, right?
Exactly, ensuring non-domination.
Right, but then when you look at the actual execution, the sheer amount of administrative heavy lifting required to actually participate in the system is, well, it's astonishing.
It really is. I mean, just to give a sense of the density here, we're looking at, what, three nested operational cycles?
Yeah, three cycles. The Q1 through Q10 hard gates and 15 highly detailed appendices that govern everything from risk margins to consequence ledgers.
Right.
It's honestly a bit like handing a local community leader a 500-page engineering schematic for a commercial airliner, when what they actually need in that moment is, you know, a laminated flight checklist just to safely operate the machinery.
That is, yeah, that's the perfect analogy.
Because the schematic is accurate. It represents brilliant constitutional engineering. But out there on the runway, handing someone that giant binder is just completely paralyzing.
Totally paralyzing. And we see this paralysis most acutely in the protocol's two-key entry rule.
Oh, yeah.
Which, you know, in theory, is this brilliant safeguard. You have one key held by the responsible institutional actor and one key held by the affected community.
Right, so the laboratory can't proceed unless both turn their keys.
Exactly. It mathematically ensures shared authorization. But the weakness here is that the administrative burden required to exercise this power is just immense. From marginalized communities or grassroots duty bearers to effectively participate and actually turn their key, they basically have to navigate a massive bureaucracy.
Because they don't just get to walk in and say yes or no.
Right.
They have to prove their right to be in the room first.
Exactly. Just to gain standing, they have to complete these incredibly complex matrices like Appendix C for effectiveness and authority.
Right.
Then they have to navigate Appendix G to establish protective margins and Appendix L just to participate in the gate decisions.
Which is just so much paperwork.
It is. And this density inadvertently risks recreating the exact power asymmetry the protocol explicitly tries to prevent. Because think about it, only institutional incumbents have the salaried staff, the endless time, and the grant funding to process this level of documentation.
Yeah, a grassroots community organizer simply does not have the bandwidth to fill out Appendix C while also, you know, holding down a full-time job.
Precisely.
But I can see exactly what the author is going for here. The protocol is trying to build an airtight constitutional architecture so that marginalized voices cannot legally be sidelined by powerful institutions.
Right. They want to lock it down.
But let me challenge this a bit, because if we dilute the paperwork requirements for the community, don't we risk losing the rigor that keeps the institution accountable? Like, how do we resolve this tension without watering down those protections?
Well, the suggestion here is that we don't dilute the rigor, but we change who carries the weight of it. We need to implement a progressive disclosure or like a modular stepping stone architecture for the protocol's requirements, specifically tailored to the user's role.
Okay, progressive disclosure.
Yeah, because right now, every single stakeholder is forced to look at the entire 500-page schematic. We need to modularize it so that participants only interact with the complexity that is strictly required for their specific phase and their specific decision rights.
So only revealing the information necessary for the immediate task at hand. What does that actually look like for, you know, a community organizer looking down the barrel of 15 appendices?
Think about decoupling the requirements entirely. So, for example, we could build a simplified community authority primer.
A primer, okay.
Yeah. This primer would extract only the matrices strictly necessary for the community's decision rights.
Leaving the rest out.
Exactly. The responsible institution still has to fill out the massive, rigorous compliance architecture because, well, they are the ones with the compliance officers and the resources to do so.
Right. They have the budget for it.
Exactly. But the community gets a streamlined, highly accessible interface that gives them all the context they need to turn their key without requiring them to essentially earn a law degree first.
I love that. That structurally shifts the burden of proof and the burden of paperwork on the entity with the most power.
Exactly.
But what about the gates themselves, like the Q1 through Q10 hard gates apply to the entire laboratory across the board, right?
They do, and that's another area for improvement. We have to restructure the G0 through G6 gates so that they actively scale with the risk tier of the project.
Oh, I see.
Because right now, a Tier 1 low-risk laboratory is subjected to the exact same paperwork density as a Tier 3 high-stakes laboratory. And that is a massive barrier to entry.
Yeah, a huge roadblock.
Right. So if we effectively scale the bureaucracy to match the risk tier, we fix this. A grassroots Tier 1 intervention might only require like a simplified checklist to pass gates G1 and G2.
But if an institution proposes a Tier 3 intervention, like something with massive systemic impacts, that triggers the full, rigorous institutional audit.
Exactly. You scale the friction to the risk.
That makes so much sense. It honors the protocol's own internal principle of the least dominating effective means. You preserve the rigor, but apply it proportionally.
Right.
But even with a tailored primer and scaled gates, we are still dealing with heavily academic language here. How do we make the actual criteria more accessible to the people on the ground?
By creating a visual dashboard version of those Q1 through Q10 hard gates. We have to translate the heavily academic, theoretical criteria into plain language diagnostic questions for immediate use.
Do you have an example of what that would look like?
Sure. So, for instance, instead of asking a community stakeholder to evaluate a project's, quote, epistemic pluralism and non-domination,
which is quite a mouthful.
Very much so. Instead of that, the dashboard simply asks, can a less powerful participant in this project contradict a powerful actor without losing their livelihood or access to services?
Wow. Yeah, that is so much clearer.
Right? It takes the high-level structural theory and translates it directly into that usable flight checklist you mentioned earlier.
Which is brilliant. But, you know, this whole discussion about overwhelming complexity naturally leads to another major point in the material, because we just established that human beings, especially grassroots organizers, get crushed by the sheer volume of paperwork.
Absolutely.
So if they're overwhelmed by a 500-page checklist, what happens when they are asked to review a machine synthesis of 1,000 pages of systemic data? Which brings us to the AI governance.
Yes, exactly. And the strict boundary enforcing formal AI non-sovereignty overlooks the insidious risk of human cognitive surrender when dealing with complex, multi-layered system data.
Yeah, this is a fascinating architectural blind spot, because the protocol actually spends a significant amount of time in Part 4 building a cage around AI, right?
It does. It tries to ensure that AI never holds political, ethical, or diagnostic authority. The AI is firmly relegated to just a synthesis role.
Right, it's just summarizing. As I understand it from the text, the protocol operates on a strict rule of AI capability without machine sovereignty. It explicitly states that a named, accountable person and their institution must retain meaningful human institutional control.
Yes, they're legally required to have the time and knowledge to disagree with whatever the AI outputs.
But I have to push back on this purely legal boundary. Like, is there a risk that focusing solely on these formal operational boundaries completely overlooks the psychological reality of automation bias?
Oh, absolutely.
Because we see this in medicine and aviation all the time, right? Where an exhausted human eventually just trusts the machine's output because it's easier.
That is exactly the vulnerability here, and it is a massive one. The weakness is treating AI authority merely as a formal boundary. Let's picture the reality of a complex minimum viable laboratory in the field.
Okay, yeah.
The protocol requires tracking delayed spatial and ecological burden displacements across multiple timelines, monitoring relational ruptures, and cross-referencing all these interlocking appendices.
Which is an unimaginable amount of data for one person.
It's impossible. The human reviewers tasked with overseeing this are inevitably going to face massive cognitive overload. The protocol states they must have the time and knowledge to disagree. But if the protocol doesn't actively account for human exhaustion, those reviewers will formally hold authority, but functionally they'll just rubber stamp the AI syntheses.
Right, because they are simply too tired to manually double-check an algorithm's interpretation of a 1,000-page consequence ledger.
Precisely. They will surrender their sovereignty to the machine by default.
Oh, wow.
The signature on the bottom of the approval document belongs to a human, giving the illusion of control. But the actual analytical heavy lifting, like the framing of reality itself, was done by the AI.
Yeah, that is terrifying. So how do we structurally prevent that psychological surrender? I mean, if exhaustion is a given in these complex civilizational projects, how do we stop the human from just nodding along?
The suggestion is that we have to introduce specific psychological and systemic friction points into the AI review process to prevent automated compliance and ensure active human engagement.
Wait, friction? In system design, we usually spend millions of dollars trying to remove friction, you know, to make things seamless. Why on earth would we deliberately engineer roadblocks back into the workflow?
Because when things are too seamless, humans fall asleep at the wheel. We need friction to save human agency. We have to design the system so that it forces the human to pause, critically evaluate, and practically prove they are actually thinking about the output, rather than just mindlessly clicking approve.
Okay, I am intrigued by this. How do we build that adversarial dynamic into a daily workflow?
One highly effective method is requiring human reviewers to actively input a rival mechanism, drawn directly from Appendix F, into the AI workflow.
A rival mechanism? Okay, how does that work?
They must document exactly how the AI evaluated a counterargument before they are allowed to approve any consequential output. So if the AI dashboard says this ecological intervention was a complete success, the human cannot just hit approve. The system literally blocks them until they feed the AI a rival explanation.
Like asking, could this apparent local success actually be the result of a displaced ecological burden 50 miles downstream?
Exactly. They force the AI to analyze the data against the rival theory. It forces the human to act as an adversarial interrogator rather than a passive consumer of a neat, synthesized narrative.
I love that. You are structurally mandating that the human plays devil's advocate. It completely breaks the trance of automation bias.
Exactly.
Are there other ways to test if the human is actually paying attention?
Yeah. Think about a randomized audit protocol.
Okay.
The Independent Boundary Institution could occasionally insert a deliberate, highly visible false variable into the AI synthesis. It's a controlled test.
Oh, that is just like the vigilance checks they use for air traffic controllers or radar operators, where they put a ghost blip on the screen just to make sure the operator is actively scanning the horizon and not, you know, zoning out.
Exactly the same principle. It ensures the accountable human reviewer is actually verifying the underlying data, not just skimming the executive summary. If the human reviewer signs off on a synthesis that includes the deliberate error, it triggers an immediate, mandatory pause and a review of their cognitive load and verification processes.
That's a great safeguard, but let's look at the root cause for a second. If cognitive load and sheer exhaustion are what drive this automation bias in the first place, how do we address the exhaustion itself? Like, a ghost blip catches them falling asleep, but how do we prevent them from being sleep-deprived from the start?
By adding a specific cognitive load assessment to Appendix K, which is the Data, Knowledge, and AI Use Register.
Okay, what would that assessment do?
This would require duty bearers to tangibly prove they have allocated sufficient dedicated work hours for the human reviewer to manually verify the AI outputs.
Oh, so they can't just pile it on?
Right. An institution cannot just assign this massive review task as an extra duty on top of an employee's existing 60-hour work week. They have to mathematically demonstrate that the human has the actual temporal and mental bandwidth required to maintain that meaningful institutional control.
That's fantastic. Because if humans surrender to AI out of pure exhaustion, it's really because the system architecture is ignoring the realities of human messiness and limitation.
Completely. And that really leads us to ask, where else is the protocol ignoring human messiness? Which brings us to our final critique.
Yes, the reliance on structured, independent administrators to handle relational ruptures risks over-institutionalizing deeply visceral human conflicts. Yeah, this is perhaps the most sensitive, nuanced, and honestly critical area of the entire protocol. Because the framework introduces this profound concept of living coordination, which is meant to be the affective relational substrate of the whole laboratory.
Right.
And what I find so compelling is how the material defines that coordination. It explicitly says that living coordination doesn't demand forced harmony or coercive civility. It pushes back aggressively against the therapeuticization of structural injustice.
It does, which is brilliant.
It beautifully validates justified anger and emotional refusal as legitimate indicators that suppressed reality has finally gained standing.
Yes.
But, and here's the massive contradiction. While the material conceptually validates justified anger, does the formal grievance and appeal process accidentally bureaucratize the very emotion it claims has a right to exist?
It completely bureaucratizes it. The weakness here is that when addressing actual, visceral conflict, the protocol pivots heavily in Part 3 to highly legalistic mechanisms.
Right.
If a marginalized community member feels silenced or experiences a profound relational rupture with an institutional actor, the protocol directs them to a process involving a 24-hour urgent action, a 10-day initial determination, written reasons, and an independent trustee managing a financial remedy reserve.
It is a staggering mismatch in tone. I mean, you have a community that is deeply angry because of a historical injury or a lived power imbalance, and the protocol responds by essentially saying, please submit your evidence to the independent trustees so we can issue a written determination in 10 business days.
Exactly. It's so cold. Converting structural injustice, emotional refusal, or profound mistrust into a formal grievance with an evidentiary standard risks completely dehumanizing the relationship.
Wow, yeah.
It shifts the burden of proof entirely onto the affected party to navigate this intimidating institutional process just to prove their pain is real. This directly contradicts the protocol's own anti-pathologization rule, which explicitly states that conflict shouldn't be treated as a procedural deficit.
Taking visceral human pain and turning it into paperwork is like the ultimate procedural deficit.
It really is.
So how do we fix this? How do we build a system that respects the anger without demanding a court docket?
The suggestion is to embed relational, non-bureaucratic conflict transformation mechanisms directly into the G-gate cycles. We have to catch and hold these ruptures long before they escalate to a formal remedy plan. We need a layer of relational repair that operates entirely outside the legalistic grievance framework.
Okay, but let's talk about what that looks like in practice. Because if we remove the evidentiary standard, doesn't this just become a toothless venting session? Like, where's the accountability?
It's about changing the currency of the accountability. For example, we can formalize a pause and sense step.
A pause and sense step?
Yeah. This will be a recognized space where the living coordination convener facilitates a non-recorded, non-punitive dialogue session. And crucially, this session does not require an evidentiary standard, and it does not result in a formal written determination.
So it's completely off the books, so to speak.
Exactly. It is simply a legitimate, protected space for the community to voice mistrust or anger without having to build a legal case to justify their feelings. It validates the emotion purely as a human experience.
I see. That preserves the dignity of the participants without forcing them into an adversarial courtroom dynamic.
Right.
But what if the conflict is beyond dialogue? What if it requires an actual, tangible shift in power? Because the protocol currently relies heavily on that ring-fenced financial remedy reserve to fix things.
And money doesn't fix a toxic power dynamic.
True.
We need to introduce the concept of relational restitution alongside financial compensation. Often, a marginalized community doesn't just want a payout from a reserve. They want immediate, structural changes in the laboratory's power dynamics.
Like what?
Relational restitution would allow communities to demand structural changes, like removing a specific institutional actor who is causing harm or altering who holds agenda-setting power for the next cycle. And they can do this entirely outside of the ring-fenced remedy reserve process.
That is incredibly powerful because it treats power and the relinquishing of power as the actual currency of repair rather than just throwing capital at the problem.
Exactly.
The community can demand a relational shift without waiting for a 10-day institutional verdict. Is there a way to integrate this softer relational data into the highly structured ledger system the protocol already uses? Like, how do we track this?
Absolutely. we can include a no-fault rupture log inside Appendix J, the consequence ledger.
Oh, interesting.
Right now, Appendix J is designed to track anomalies, adverse effects, and formal grievances. By adding a no-fault rupture log, relational breakdowns, moments of severe mistrust, or emotional withdrawals can be documented and validated by the system as vitally important data points, but without triggering a full formal investigation.
So it's still visible, but it doesn't trigger the bureaucracy.
Exactly. The rupture is acknowledged by the system as real and impactful, but it doesn't automatically drag the affected community into a bureaucratic tribunal unless they specifically request that escalation.
Well, a key theme running through our entire discussion today is really the necessity of scaling this protocol's formidable architecture to fit the human reality of the people actually using it.
Absolutely.
We looked at easing the immense administrative burden by introducing a progressive disclosure architecture, ensuring that marginalized communities aren't crushed by paperwork just to earn their seat at the table.
Right.
We explored combating automation bias by adding deliberate cognitive friction to AI reviews, ensuring that human sovereignty remains an active interrogation, not a passive rubber stamp.
Crucial.
And finally, we discussed preventing the over-bureaucratization of human conflict by building in non-legalistic relational restitution, allowing visceral pain to be met with structural power shifts rather than evidentiary standards.
The foundational theory in this document is incredibly robust. The commitment to anti-pathologization and non-domination is profoundly necessary for the kind of civilizational healing this framework envisions. By adjusting these operational mechanisms, like simplifying the user interface, guarding against cognitive exhaustion, and making dedicated space for human messiness, these refinements will make the framework far more resilient and effective when it hits the messy reality of the real world.
We deeply appreciate the listener for submitting such a thoughtful, rigorously designed protocol. The intention behind this work is vital, and we warmly invite you to submit your revised work to the critique again in the future. Because at the end of the day, you can have the most brilliant, comprehensive engineering schematic in the world, but if the goal is to actually get this project off the ground, you have to hand the community the checklist so they can finally take flight.